Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Kelly Jean Kelly, this time exploring terms that relate to or include the color blue. Later, Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith bring us the latest in the ongoing American History Series, Making of a Nation, this time exploring the early days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's presidency. But first, the Higher Education Report, with a look at the inequality minorities in many mostly white countries face in higher education and work. A recent study suggests that higher education in the United States helps white people more financially than it does other groups. The finding makes some education experts question the effectiveness of U.S. efforts to fight racial injustice. At the same time, other experts note that systemic inequality and racial discrimination are not limited to the United States. Last October, the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce published a study on U.S. college graduates. Researchers looked at the earnings of white, black, and Latino Americans who had earned a bachelor's degree between 1991 and 2016. Over that period, blacks and Latinos with a bachelor's degree increased their likelihood of getting and keeping a good-paying job. The Georgetown researchers defined such a position as one paying at least $35,000 a year. But in 2016, white college graduates held 77% of the good-paying jobs. These men and women represented 69% of available job holders nationwide. The study also showed that whites holding a bachelor's degree and working in a good job earned about $10,000 more a year than blacks and Latinos with the same education.
Anthony Carnevale is the director of the Georgetown Center. He describes the findings as just another example of America's long history of treating minorities unequally. The first blacks to arrive in North America came as slaves. Even after the United States banned slavery, many southern states created Jim Crow laws. These rules barred African Americans from many schools and fields of employment. Carnevale told VOA that conditions for black Americans improved somewhat over the years. But following World War II, many whites moved out of major U.S. cities, thanks in part to the financial aid they received for their military service. This made it possible for majority white communities to build large tax bases, which helped finance strong public school systems, he said. This then made it possible for more whites to attend colleges and universities. Carnevale added that Latinos did not become a major part of the U.S. economy until the late 1980s. He said they faced much the same discrimination as blacks. In more recent times, there have been efforts to reduce barriers to higher education, especially for minorities. For the most part, however, this has meant sending Black, Latino, and poor students to 2- and 4-year public colleges and universities. State governments give far less financial support to these schools than they used to, noted Carnevale. This means many of the schools struggle to support students as best they can. So, we've created more access to higher education in America, but we have not created much more success, he said. The success, the graduation rates are highest by far for affluent white kids.
Victor Goud argues that the inequality issue goes beyond education and extends into many other areas of American life. Goud is the education director for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, a U.S.-based civil rights group. To date, the U.S. government continues to face problems in dealing with inequality in many areas, says Goud. In 2019, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights reported a lack of resources for anti-discrimination efforts at 13 federal agencies. It found that these agencies lacked the money to investigate claims of discrimination in employment, housing, and voting. Goud adds that a little over 65 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled states could not prevent Black students from attending the same schools as whites. But this year, a New Jersey judge agreed to consider a court case against the state's public school system. The NAACP and other groups have accused the state of segregation based on race and earnings. The NAACP has also taken legal action to demand greater financial support for public schools from state governments in Maryland, Delaware, and Minnesota. States need to see how they can do a better job of providing an adequate, equitable education to all students, noted Goud.
While every country is different, this kind of inequality exists in many majority white nations, says Kiriaki Topidi. She is a researcher with the European Center for Minority Issues. Topidi notes that in Germany, many recent African and Middle Eastern immigrants lack access to high schools with advanced study programs. And studies showed that employers in Britain were 60% more likely to consider white candidates for employment than blacks or South Asians. Topidi suggests one way to deal with this is by working with local governments to create anti-discrimination policies. Also, she said, leaders should try to get members of different races and economic levels to understand each other better through community building events and training. This process should be based on the acceptance that people do not simply represent ethnicities or races, but rather are complex beings that also differ according to social status, interests, profession, beliefs, she said. Yet Anthony Carnevale is not hopeful that conditions for blacks and Latinos will improve in the United States anytime soon. He says that unless wealthy white Americans are willing to spend much more in taxes to support public education, things will likely remain the same for the next 30 years. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, it's time for Words and Their Stories, our weekly program about common everyday expressions in American English. Usually, we talk about words and phrases that Americans use without even thinking much about them. But, of course, anybody can make up a phrase and give it meaning. By the way, there's actually a phrase for this act. To coin a phrase means to invent a new saying. The Grammarist website explains that using the word coin as a verb began in the 1300s. It related to putting an image on a piece of metal money. But the expression did not come about until 500 years later, when some English speaker coined the phrase to coin a phrase. Anyway, today we begin with a phrase that scientist Wallace Nichols coined in more recent years. It explains how people feel when they are near water. That phrase is blue mind. It is also the name of Wallace's book, published in 2014. He uses the phrase to mean a sense of calm and happiness one has near a lake, river, ocean, or other body of water. In this phrase, the color blue is positive. It suggests both the color of water and a feeling of mental quiet. The color blue is also sometimes linked to a feeling of security, say researchers who study how colors make people feel. If you call someone true blue, you mean you can depend on her completely. A true blue friend is loyal and trustworthy. A friend like that is extremely valuable. You might even say that someone who is true blue is worth her weight in gold. But that would be mixing idioms. In some phrases, blue relates to being the best. If you win top prize, you win a blue ribbon. Sometimes you really do get a piece of fabric that is the color blue. But you can also just describe something that is excellent with the adjective blue ribbon, such as a blue ribbon restaurant. In business, a successful company that has a very positive public image can be called a blue chip operation. If you own a piece of that company, then you own blue chip stock. Anything that is of high quality can be blue chip. A writer on the business website Motley Fool reports that English speakers started using the term in the early 1900s. It relates to the game of poker. In the game, people use flat, round pieces called chips. The blue chips had the highest value. At the end of the game, players exchanged their chips for real money. So it is no surprise that the more blue chips you gain, the better. But in some other English expressions, the word blue is linked to some more complex ideas. If you have the blues, you are sad, even depressed. The website Word Histories says that this sorrowful meaning appeared in a story in England in the 1400s. The color blue related to skin that was hurt or bruised. Artists may also go through a blue period. This is a time when their work suggests painful feelings. Hopefully, those low times do not come very often, perhaps once in a blue moon. This expression has come to mean happening rarely. It refers to the unusual times when one month includes two full moons. The second moon is a blue moon. Such an event is seen as special and noteworthy. In comparison, something that is a bolt from the blue is unexpected and usually bad. Let's say you and your business partner had just launched a new store. You thought you were working well together, So the news that she was leaving to take a new job was a bolt from the blue. The idea is that of lightning or thunder appearing in a cloudless sky. News of unexpected illness or a sudden death can also be a bolt from the blue. So, what does the color blue mean for you? Calmness, loyalty, sadness, surprise, or something else? After all, every culture and every person reacts to colors differently. Here's a fun challenge for you. Coin your own phrase with the color blue and send it to us in the comments section. Until next time, this is Words and Their Stories. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember with Shirley Griffith. We begin the story of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1932, Americans were tired of the policies of Republican President Herbert Hoover. They thought Hoover had done too little to fight the Depression that was crushing the economy. They gave a big victory to Franklin Roosevelt and his Democrats in the elections that year. Roosevelt believed that the federal government should do more to help average Americans. The election brought hope to many Americans in the autumn of 1932. But Roosevelt did not become president until March of 1933, 4 months after the election. And those months saw the American economy fall to its lowest level in the history of the nation.
President Hoover tried to arrange a World Economic Conference, and he called on President-elect Roosevelt to join him in making conservative statements in support of business. Roosevelt refused. He did not think it was correct to begin acting like a president until he actually became the president. He did not want to tie himself to policies that the voters had just rejected. Congress, controlled by Democrats, also refused to help Hoover.
It was a strange period, a season of uncertainty and anger. The economy was worse than ever. The lines of people waiting for food were longer than before. Angry mobs of farmers were gathering in the countryside. And the politicians in Washington seemed unable to work together to end the crisis. Hoover said, "We are at the end of our rope. There is nothing more we can do." And across the country, Americans waited, worried, uncertain, afraid. What would the new president do?
The new president was 51 years old. His family name was well known to the American public. Theodore Roosevelt, a distant family member, had served as one of America's greatest presidents 30 years earlier. Franklin Roosevelt was born to a rich and important New York family. He went to the best schools, Groton, Harvard, and Columbia Law School. In 1910, he won election to the New York State Legislature. He showed great intelligence and political understanding as a state senator, and worked hard for other Democratic candidates. Franklin Roosevelt next served as Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson. And in 1920, he was the Democratic Party's unsuccessful candidate for vice president.
The next year, Roosevelt suffered a personal tragedy. He was sailing during a holiday with his family. Suddenly, his body became cold. He felt severe pain in his back and legs. Doctors came, but the pain got worse. For weeks, Roosevelt was forced to lie on his back. Finally, doctors discovered that Roosevelt was a victim of polio. He lost control of his legs because of the disease. He would never walk again. Roosevelt had always been an active man who loved sports, but now he would have to live with a wheelchair. All of his money and fame could not get him back the strength in his legs.
Many Americans thought the illness would end Roosevelt's political dreams, but they were wrong. He showed an inner strength that people had never seen in him before. Roosevelt ran as the Democratic candidate for governor of New York State in 1928. He won by a small number of votes. 2 years later, the voters of New York re-elected Roosevelt, and they cheered his creative efforts to help citizens of the state who were suffering from the Great Depression.
Franklin Roosevelt always appeared strong and friendly in public. He loved to laugh and enjoy life. But his happy face hid a strong will. Throughout his life, Roosevelt worked to improve life for the common man. And he was willing to use the power of government to do this. He thought the government had the power and responsibility to improve the life of its citizens.
Roosevelt believed deeply in this, but he was less certain about the best way to do it. Above all, we must try something, he said, during the presidential campaign of 1932. Roosevelt believed that the country demanded creative experimentation. Americans in large numbers across the country voted for Roosevelt in 1932. They supported his calls for action to end the Depression. But no one was really sure just what this new president from New York, this man unable to walk, would really do after he entered the White House.
Inauguration Day in 1933 began with clouds and a dark sky. Roosevelt went to church in the morning, and then he drove with President Hoover from the White House to the Capitol, the building where Congress meets. Roosevelt tried to talk with Hoover as they drove, but Hoover said little. He just waved without emotion at the crowd. The two men arrived at the Capitol. A huge crowd of people waited. Millions more Americans listened to a radio broadcast of the ceremony. The Chief Justice of the United States, Charles Evans Hughes, gave the oath of office to Roosevelt. And then Americans waited to hear what the nation's 32nd president would say. He told them he was sure they expected him to speak openly and honestly about the situation facing the country. he told them that their great nation would survive as it had survived in the past, that it would recover and become rich again. He talked about the danger of fear, a nameless fear that blocked efforts to move forward. And he talked about Americans giving their support to honest, active leadership in every dark hour of their history. Here is some of Roosevelt's inaugural address in his own words.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
Roosevelt's words caught the emotions of the crowd. He seemed sure of himself. He promised leadership. His whole style was different from the empty promises of wealth offered by President Hoover.
Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort, the joy, the moral stimulation of work. No longer must be forgotten in the mad chase of evanescent profit.
These dark days, my friends, will be worth all they cost us
if they teach us that our true destiny is not to be ministered unto, but to minister to ourselves, to our fellow men.
Roosevelt said that the most important need was to put people back to work. And he said the federal government would have to take an active part in creating jobs. Roosevelt said there were many ways to help the nation recover. But, he said, it would never be helped just by talking about it. We must act, he said, and act quickly.
Roosevelt had a strong and serious look on his face. He told the crowd that all the necessary action was possible under the American system of government. But he warned that Congress must cooperate with him to get the nation moving again. Then, his speech finished, Roosevelt waved to the crowd and smiled. Herbert Hoover shook his hand and left. Roosevelt rode alone through the huge crowds back to the White House, and he immediately began a series of conferences.
Roosevelt's inauguration speech of 1933 was one of the most powerful and important speeches in American history. Roosevelt's speech was like an ocean wave that washes away one period of history and brings in a new one. The president seemed strong. He gave people hope. The new president promised the American people action, and action came quickly. During the next 3 months, Roosevelt and the Democrats would pass more major new programs than the nation had seen in many years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.